podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is Tour Live, come and see everywhere apart from Facebook. I am Neil Atkinson and I am joined by Adam Melia, Dan Austin and John Gibbons. Coming up, we are going to be speaking to Stephen Smith and Gary Judge about access and the work that they do involving the boxing community in there as well. And we are also, John Gibbons, who are you speaking to?
Speaking to Adam Rowe. He's got a new special on YouTube. I watched it last night. It's funny.
Is it funny?
Yeah.
It's got jokes.
I laughed.
That's good news, given its premise.
He's coming in.
Is he
good news for that as well?
He's coming in 43 minutes. It's a good job you're entertained by it. That is very, very important indeed. We will be talking about the game against Brighton and Hove Albion. If you are watching this on YouTube / other platforms that aren't Facebook, you will see that me, John and Dan are gathered together at the studio, because as soon as Adam Rowe leaves this building, we are also leaving this building and jumping in a car.
If he's not careful.
If he plays his cards right, some would say. If he plays his cards right, he might end up coming.
In the car by mistake.
Yeah, we're rattling all the way down to Brighton. That is what we're doing. We're doing a live show in Brighton tonight at the Arch. If you want to come along, we will be at the Arch this evening. But before then, we're going to talk about the game coming up against Brighton. But we're also going to have a look in the general at the top 10 picture, somewhat framed by Chelsea, yet again going to absolute pieces last night. Let's start with that, to be honest with you, Dan. They go and get the funky new loan sign and they're paying £12 million for 6 months. And he gets himself sent off. Now, he was lively before then, by all accounts. Let me be clear, I did not watch that game last night, and I don't expect you will have watched it either. But you are on top of the general information. And Chelsea seem absolutely mad at the minute, and they've seemed absolutely mad since Todd Bowley's turned up.
Yeah, just increasingly miserable as well, to go with the madness. It seemed like at the start it was at least funny. If you're just lashing a load of money at different people and sometimes getting results and sometimes not, when it's exclusively not, as it has been since before the World Cup, I think now, then that's an awful lot less interesting. They've just spent it on an awful lot of people that they, within 6 months, have needed to replace. So they signed various centre-halves.
The Koulibaly thing is the maddest. Well,
they've already bought another €40 million centre-half. They bought a forward. They've already had to pay €12 million to have a forward come in on loan. They've bought another forward as well, haven't they, from Sweden, I think he's come from. So they've just not done it very well. The man seems to have... I mean, he must have a sense of business acumen to have reached the point that he has in his life. I'm not buying that, like, billionaires are inherently intelligent people by any means, because I think in an awful lot of cases they're not. But he must have had something at some point, and nothing since he joined Chelsea actually suggests it. So he's either lost it or gone insane, is what it implies.
So Premier League football, not Premier League football does this to people, I think. I think this is one of the... Dan, this is one of the things to remember at all times, that there's a long lineage of football driving successful people, wherever they started from in life, driving successful people quite mad.
Business people especially, because it's fundamentally not a moneymaker, unless you are involved on like a governance level. Then it's probably not. Even if you're an owner of a really successful team, you're probably at best not losing money, but that's quite hard. He seems to have had the attitude that he's just going to do what he wants, and that having people talk about him is beneficial to him in some sense. So it might not be to do with Chelsea beneficial, but people around the world being more aware of Todd Bowley, going, "Oh, isn't Todd Bowley spending money?" Maybe he deems his
a nice
other
chubby face.
I've never seen his face.
Not seen his face. Whoa, whoa, whoa!
No, I have. He's got longer hair than you'd think.
Much longer hair than you think. He looks like he played rhythm guitar for Crosby, Stills and Nash. Adam.
I mean, yeah, I was going to say he looks a bit like Matt Berry in Toast.
He does look. We'll get Matt Bowley on screen, Todd Bowley on screen in a second or two. Adam, the madness of Chelsea, the madness of Bowley, it has a certain amount to recommend it. From a vaudeville basis, I like the fact that we get to know. He also was interim sporting director. He has given that up this week, but my God, he is quite something.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be nice if he had Matt Berry's voice in that. Like, I've never heard his voice. If he had that voice as well, that would be good.
Harry's auto audiobook yet?
No,
sounds a lot like Toast. It just makes it, all the more farcical.
You're a bit quiet for me, John, which is not something I've ever said in my life.
No one has.
So,
oh,
yeah.
Oh no.
What was I going to say? Yeah, it is funny, and it does suit Chelsea actually. Like if it was happening to Arsenal or don't know, you know, Tottenham, there he is. It would be it would seem a little bit more incongruous. I think it is quite congruous for it to be happening for Chelsea because they are quite circus anyway, aren't they? I think he's of a certain age. And like I wouldn't say it's a football club being ran by Twitter, but I think he's on the forums. I think that's the level of signing we're having is basically everybody that if you are also of a certain age and have been on the forums, that's the sort of player that, especially like the Koulibaly signing, that is the most of the forum era sign I've ever heard. So yeah, I'm quite enjoying that aspect of it. To be honest, I am still enjoying it. I definitely wouldn't want it.
not in my life.
Well, yeah, I mean your life, Neil. Though I mean, I reckon Chelsea's podcasts are getting a lot of mileage out of it. They're probably getting a lot of new subscribers all the time.
Honestly, the money Todd Bowley would make the Anfield rap with this sort of conduct, John. That's the good thing about Bowley, is that he's certainly helping the subscription based podcasts with his chaos. Imagine how many transfer specials you'd have done if you were looking after Chelsea by now.
Yeah, I'd be exhausted. It is. I remember once. Chris Barber, who's our unofficial Chelsea correspondent, describing his time supporting Chelsea as chaos and trophies, and I thought that was quite a nice way of putting it. They're very much in a chaos era at the moment, but you know, trophies may follow, who knows, but it just seems like, I do like the idea that Friends Fairy's on the forums again, and you know, who he's going to sort of come out with next. And it is a reminder, really, you know, we as a fan base are having a great debate about ownership at the moment, and it won't necessarily get better. I'm of the general opinion that I think FSG have taken us as far as they can in terms of, you know, their model and what they're sort of willing to do. But, you know, the idea that someone else will come and be better isn't necessarily true. And I think, you know, there's lots of ways that might be the case, you know, in terms of, you know, Glazers who are loading all the debt on, or, you know, something like, you know, Newcastle, which just isn't for me at all, you know, might be for other people, that's up to you. But also, you know, just some mad fella coming in and sporting director.
That is what people seem, I mean, without him existing, if you asked a lot of people, it seems like, you know, a nice American fella, nice looking American fella, looks like Matt Berry, is going to splash the cash a bit more than FSG. You know, that's the danger, isn't it? That is sort of what people say. What I say.
It is what you say.
But look at him. And it is the kind of, it seems to be, I think we had a little bit of this when FSG first came in, actually. I think when people from who from other backgrounds or cultures or sporting institutions try and sort of apply, you know, what they think would work there or what has worked there to football. And I think, you know, there was the very stats-based, you know, approach that FSG sort of came in with, which was the money ball, you know, you're buying runs. And I think sports in America generally a lot more individual. And, you know, baseball is a battle, similar to cricket, really, between, you know, batter and bowler. And, you know, whereas with football, you know, it is all about how you come together and how you play together and what is your style of play and who's good at that. And it feels like with Chelsea, you know, they haven't gone for that at all. It's like, well, who can we buy who's good at football? And then we'll worry about what's going to happen later. And it's never been a successful way to run or develop a team. And that's what you're seeing now. The caveat is they got loads of injuries, Chelsea, I would say that. And they are unlucky that they get this lad in and he's probably the best player on the pitch. I did watch it, and then he gets sent off straight away. And it is funny, but they are a mess.
They are good players that they've got. And I actually think that Potter's a good manager. I haven't sort of gone off him, really. I still think he's good, but definitely seems like the wrong manager. They should have got, I don't know, Ancelotti or somebody that's sort of used to mad fellas buying loads of players for him.
I don't think that the Graham Potter's evil enough for that job.
Yeah.
Anyone that's good that manages Chelsea has an inherent level of villainy about them in a pantomime way. And he just seems like a thoroughly nice man in a roll neck jumper. And I don't think it fits quite right. If he was the Arsenal manager, it'd go really well. It'd be exactly right. There's just something metaphysically wrong, and therefore he's not allowed to win games of football and will be sacked. because the universe just doesn't accept that he's in that dugout. It's not acceptable to the world. You know what I mean?
Absolutely 100%. I've just Googled Graham Potter's favourite band and sadly something doesn't come up. I'd like confirmation on this at the next press conference when he thinks he's going to get loads of questions, Adam, about his job. I'd quite like the first journalist. And let's just hypothetically say Matt Law of the Daily Mail sticks his hand up and says, Graham, what are you listening to at the moment? I would absolutely love to know what was on Graham Potter's last Spotify playlist. That's what I want to know about Graham Potter more than anything else. Whereas, as Adam says, it should be that he's an evil genius.
Yes, that was Dan's theory. I completely. That's exactly the sort of thing. I mean, like it's much more incongruous that he is Chelsea manager than Chelsea being mad and spending loads of money. That's the thing possibly that isn't right. And I sort of thought of a few weeks ago we could do the thing again where, not to tempt fate, you know, we beat a team and they sack the manager the next day. I can sort of see that, but I can also see him potentially not lasting that long, or because they've got another game before they play us. But yeah, his favorite band, I don't know. I mean, instantly the whole Weller lineage pops into my head. It's got to be
he only likes the Jam.
Well, I was thinking,
what you give us, what you get.
He's probably, I don't know how old his kids are, but he's got Tame Impala on in the car, but he'd rather listen to Weller, is my opinion.
I saw a fella in the Asda the other day who was buying Stanley Road for £1, which is a bargain in a way. But I thought I looked at him and thought, you've got Stanley Road.
John, Fulham then, you know, to go through the top of the table, I'm going to move on to Brighton in a minute or two, but Fulham find themselves. I think that Fulham had a bit of a plan around this season. Don't get me wrong. I'm not acting for a second as though the whole thing's come sort of as some sort of massive surprise. But Fulham find themselves in really good nick, in really good shape. And they've got themselves 19 games, 31 points on the board. What I think they've been brilliant at all season, and I'm not just saying it because they do it against us first game, is I think they're brilliant at sensing weakness, sensing a moment in games or a moment in a season where they can take advantage, because the underlying numbers around Fulham just are not that good. But what they are showing, I think, is a real sense of game intelligence right the way across the pitch. And that stems from the manager, to be fair, to the ex-Everton alumni. Normally, once Everton has touches you, things won't be the same again. But Marco Silva's managed to wash it off.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Neil, and I've not thought about it, because sometimes teams can talk themselves out of beating, you know, so-called bigger teams. I thought Newcastle did it at Anfield, to be honest with you. For all the talk of, you know, their tactics and what they were doing and stuff like that, they just should have fucking beat us. That's what they should have done. You know, forget morals. You know, forget morals of time wasting and stuff like that. We were rubbish, and it went to 1-1, and they just behaved in a very strange way for a team who should have just gone, we'll just go and win. Fulham would have gone and won at Anfield that night, and that's what they did on the first game of the season. And you know, they've done well whenever I've watched them, you know, which is quite a bit actually, you know, sort of coincidentally, is to approach a game and look at a game and think, you know, rather than play against Chelsea or play against, you know, the money, or, you know, they've played against the team and they've noticed that, you know, there's an opportunity there, you know, especially when they go down to 10 men, we can go on and win this game. And they have done. They've got good players as well, is what I'd say. You know, they've got energy about them. They've got a Portuguese midfielder who I think we should have bought. Like, I thought we were good at Portugal. So
he's a big lad as well.
He is, and I'm really good at football. And you know, played European football and stuff like that. And you know, our loss, if you call it that, is very much their gain. You know, but they've got, you know, other good players as well. You know, last night they're getting goals off the bench and stuff like that. You know, traditionally they've struggled for goals generally in the league, whereas now they've got sort of, you know, lads who are coming on and getting winners and stuff like that. So, yeah, they look a proper team. The confidence, the fans are behind them. I'm really pleased that Jack Collins is having a lovely time.
Very much so. And football's best man.
And yeah, long may continue.
Dan, there is something here around, you know, I look ahead of us. Now Fulham are in that category as well. Liverpool dropped down to seventh. Fulham win last night makes that happen. I look ahead of us and I'm not that impressed by any of Newcastle, Man United or Tottenham. I'm impressed with the results, and I'm impressed with the fact that they're not dissimilar to Fulham in the case, I think, of Newcastle and Manchester United. And John's right to cite our game as a time when Newcastle didn't do it, but they very much managed to get results in the games where they should. But I don't think any of these sides play anything that can be described as scintillating football. You don't need scintillating football to come top four, though, and I think this is a way we need to recalibrate a little bit for the challenges that are to come. I don't believe that Newcastle or Manchester United are playing great stuff, but they don't need to play great stuff to stay third and fourth, and we need to get on board that train.
Yeah, I'm not impressed by them in terms of like the pantheon of teams that I've seen play Premier League football over 20 years or so. But I'm impressed by them in comparison with who they're competing against.
Yeah.
In that Newcastle are extremely difficult to beat. That game that John was talking about is literally the only one that they've lost in the league. It must also be the only one they've lost domestically because they're still in both of the cups.
They're not
the
copy by Sheffield.
Oh, no, they copy by Sheffield Wednesday, didn't they? Sorry. So they've lost two then. and one's a cup game. And United for the first time in what feels like forever have a way of playing at the very least that they all seem to have bought into and have decided that that's the way forward, and it doesn't mean that it's great right now, and it seems like it needs various players added to it to be properly good, but you don't have to be properly good at the moment. I would love for Liverpool to be anything like as difficult to beat or score against as what Newcastle are, but they're not even close.
There's a thing I was talking to Alex Hirst yesterday on Friday's show. Download the app. Friday's show is brilliant this week, by the way. But what he talked about was Dan Burn's left back. In front of Dan Burn is some combination of Joe Willock and Joe Linton.
And Joe Linton's playing left wing. So how are you getting past that? It's really hard. And they'll by and large,
it's hard.
They're good enough to score a goal.
Yeah.
So they might just beat you 1-0 or draw 1-1 or draw 0-0 or something like that. So, I mean, they drew with Leeds recently. They drew a home with Bournemouth. It's not like these are all good results. And you're going, wow, what an amazing season they're having. But if you're really consistently hard to score against and beat, then teams are not going to turn up with the belief that they're going to do either of those things. Whereas when they play against Liverpool, they're thinking, right, we're probably going to score first. What's our plan for when we score first? How do we then deal with that? Do we go for more? Do we sit off? What do we do? So that means that, at the moment, if you ask other teams throughout the league who they'd rather play against, I'm sure they'd rather play against Liverpool than against Newcastle because it's quite literally easier. You're more likely to get something out of Liverpool.
Recalibrating what we're about, Adam, I think is actually been something that I think we found a little bit difficult this season. There's been a couple of games where I think we've looked to have done it and looked to have done it quite well. But for me, it remains the, without getting into purchasing another footballer, which we can do, but for me, it remains the core thing that we've just sort of failed to get on board with, that ultimately going back to being horrible for a period here, that this will be a grind, a graft. We've done this before. We did it in 2020, 2021. We did it in 2016, 17. Becoming horrible to face is, I think, the next thing that we really need to do. We'll talk about Brighton in a minute, but I think it starts at Brighton. I think Brighton have got to find the whole enterprise as dispiriting as we currently are, because that's the way in which we're going to get 3 points.
Yeah, I mean, and horrible in any way. We can choose any other ways to be horrible, really. It, at our best, it's a hostile ground. It's a hostile, we're in teams' faces. We moan with the best of them. We fight as a unit. We're fast and strong. And at the minute, we're just absolutely none of those things. And we're a dream to play against, which is why, teams probably would say they'd rather play at Anfield and at St James's Park, I think, at the moment. So, I mean, you mentioned Tottenham, Newcastle and Man United. I don't know why you've grouped them together, but I don't think much of Tottenham. I haven't watched much of Man United, but I am impressed with their results. And I think we've already talked a bit about Newcastle, and I can imagine them maybe if they just keep doing what they're doing, just missing out, to be honest, on top four, because that's, as you said, there's not tons of goals there, and I expect somebody, hopefully us, and maybe somebody else, to get their act together, possibly Tottenham, and push them out. But I mean, just to go back to Man United, I think that their results are impressing me, and I think that there is enough. There's enough there to say that they look like they're starting to be a frightening prospect to play against a bit. I think they already kind of have that a bit because of who they are, and they're always there. They're lurking in the background. Big fan base, big ground. If they're up for it, then it's not nice, and that quite quickly has turned itself on, I think. I'm not particularly looking forward to them coming to Anfield, and I think that you know, regardless of that, because, you know, any of these teams coming to Anfield, you know, I'd hope to beat them. It's more what they're going to do when they go to other places. And Man United are getting some impressive results, and it seems to be quite a consistent, you know, it's the same, as you say, the way of playing. It's the same players scoring. Rashford scored in the last four or five games in a row. They just look like winning, I think, every time they play. Whether that's through scintillating football or not massively difficult fixtures, but them in a big row gives you momentum going into your next tough one, whatever that is. So yeah, they're the ones that can concern me the most, not just because I hate them. They do look like they've got it together, unfortunately, for the first time in a while.
But for our point of view, John, all these sides are playing each other. So Brighton are around us, let's be clear about that, but they are beneath us. And I think that I think in everyone's heads, Brighton are playing some absolutely marvellous stuff. But they are beneath us at the time this game kicks off when we go to the Amex, John. And we'll come on and talk about that game in a minute or two. But before we get there, I just want to sort of, you know, point out that we've got Chelsea coming up after Brighton, then we've got Wolves, then we've got Everton. They're our next four. And whilst that's going on, all these teams are playing each other, as has been said in the comments there. All these teams are playing each other. And I think that all of this happening is something which, all of a sudden, then the league picture can look really, really different. But we've got to get our act together. And as I say, I don't think getting our act together is whacking anyone. I don't think that's what we should be about at this sort of point. I think it is becoming the team that no one wants to face. And how we do that with the current personnel that the manager's got at his disposal is, I think, the biggest challenge that he has. Maybe in a couple of senses, the biggest challenge he's had, certainly since he didn't have any centre-halves. But he's got to make that happen some way, John.
Yeah, he has, absolutely. And that is the challenge here, because, you know, it's all well and good, you know, saying people will drop points in these next coming games because they're sort of playing each other. But, you know, to take advantage of that, we need to win our games and you need to win the games that you should do. Now, Brighton are playing so well that, you know, there's an argument that is that, you know, a game you should win or would that be a good win? You know, if they win there, I'd probably argue it is a good win, you know, now if you go to Brighton and win. But I think generally speaking, the other teams around us have been better at winning their winnable games. And I think, you know, Manchester United have won four in a row. Now, they've had a really nice run since Christmas, it should be said, in terms of the teams that they've played, but they've still beat them. They've still sort of gone and done it really ways. You look at, you know, some of our results, you know, of going to Nottingham Forest and things like that, you know, really sort of disappointing performances and really poor defeats. You know, they've been, you know, littered sort of throughout the season, really. And so we need to get much better at those. You know, the manager needs to find a solution. Is that going to be in the transfer market? We shall see. We're all hopeful that someone else will come in. But regardless, it's, you know, do we make ourselves tougher to beat and back our forwards to get on the end of something? You know, you put the table up before and noticed we've conceded twice as many goals as Newcastle, which is mad, twice as many. And so do we sort of say, well, we're going to be just tougher to beat. We're going to sit in a little bit more and rely on, you know, our pacey forwards, you know, on the break, or do we, you know, back ourselves to be pressing high, to be getting in amongst people and to cause sort of havoc that way, whatever it is. You know, you said, you know, tougher to play against, and that's it. Whether you rock hard, resolute, can't get through us, or you're harrying the life out of people, you know, whichever one it is, we need to commit to it better and make it happen.
Okay, this is Tour Live. Download the app for more and more from the Anfield Wrap coming up. You've got Stephen Smith and Gary Judge, and you've got Adam Rowe as well. Partnering with Access Sport Colleges, the Anfield Wrap, really pleased and proud to do so. We had a good chat this week about everything that's going on. Asked Gary to come in. He's brought Stephen Smith with him. We'll get to Stephen in a second or two. But Gary, part of what Access Sport are trying to do is move just beyond football. Loads and loads of really good stuff around football as well. But there's other areas of sport that Access are looking to educate 16 to 18-year-olds in.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're open to supporting any sports person or young athlete, to be fair. We've got, for instance, a programme down in Norwich where we've got an elite swimmer who's on our programme. So he'll do his education in the morning, he'll go off to the pool in the afternoon and swim, and, you know, it allows him to have more training time and exposure to his coaches than he would ordinarily in a standard college programme. That's what we're about really, is trying to keep that dream alive for the young people, but also giving them that backup of the education programme?
The education programme is absolutely massive, and you brought in working with Stephen and others around the idea to get more and more going with boxing. How's that happened and how's that going?
Well, to be fair, we kicked it off a few years ago. You know, we had a few chats, you know, Stephen, Paul, you know, Liam and Callum were involved somewhat as well, and they've always been really passionate as a family about giving something back, and you know, they're very close in the community anyway. The Rotunda is a massive community gym, and that's been a gym that's been a big part of the lads' development. And so we done it a few years ago, and we had a lot of successes from it, and we got to a stage where all of the lads, without talking for them, were at different stages of the career, and they felt it was probably better to put it on ice, so to speak, until the time was right for some of them. And you know, Stephen come to me 6 months ago and said, look, you know, he's obviously retired. He's always been very passionate about the development of boxers, and he enjoys coaching. So, you know, it's great for us to have them back on board, particularly Stephen, and you know, at a stage of his life where he wants to really, you know, give something back from a coaching point of view and developing young fighters. And it's a pleasure for us. And I think it's a you know, real good opportunity for young people.
Gyms thrive on young people. Even I know that, Stephen, and I don't know anything, but even I know that gyms thrive on young people. That's the energy that drives you, that gets you gets everyone involved going every single day. So an opportunity to work with Access must be really exciting.
Yeah, it's massive. And as you just said then, with you know, the young people, you don't end up with the superstars in any sport without starting off with the young one. They all start somewhere, and getting the best development and, you know, making them as technically good as you can younger will definitely put them in good stead to be the best they can be when they do reach, you know, whatever potential they've got.
Within that potential, what I think, you know, having had conversations with Access this week and in weeks prior to them coming on board with us, one of the things that I've been intrigued by is that what matters when you talk about reaching that potential and that development is that obviously everyone's potential in any sport has a bit of a ceiling, and it's given people the opportunity to have things, skills, learning to fall back on. And I think that's, for instance, where the gyms fall in really nicely with Access, because the discipline aspect of all that sort of stuff on the one hand, but on the other hand, it also means that you're able to work with these young people knowing that the safety net isn't just a safety net, it's an elevator that they can climb, a ladder they can climb if the boxing doesn't work for them.
Of course, 100%, and that's good having the, you know, the both aspects with the education on it, giving them something to fall back, you know. And I do think you know, when you mentioned there the ceiling, the amount of young kids that never even reach the ceiling, never get close to the ceiling, is unfortunate, really. And it's something that what this sort of type of setup will help kids, you know, push on, you know, get closer to the ceiling, and let's see what they've got. And I think, you know, having the chance to technically develop kids and help them, you know, better themselves as well, you know, working with their own boxing clubs is something what I think is a great aspect for going forward.
Yeah, no, and I think certainly from the ceiling point of view, that's something I'm really passionate about. I don't feel, and not about me here, but we've all got these stories when we get to this age, I don't think I ever really reached my ceiling from a football perspective. And I look back and think, you know, if I had the opportunity rather than the old school scholarships to be able to achieve that and to enjoy my football and to keep doing it in an environment where I was supported with experts, you know, I think there's you know, I'm not sure where it would have taken me, but That's I think that's something we're really passionate about.
When you talk about with boxing clubs, it isn't just the idea that it's got to be just yours, is it? And that's a key part of this, Stephen. It's boxing clubs in the area in a much wider sense.
That's the beauty of this, and it's something which I'm really enjoying about, you know, I'm really looking forward to personally, because what it means is, you know, all the kids that come in, you know, if we just talk about the Merseyside area, the kids are going to be coming to us, and you know, them kids are going to be affiliated with a club. 99% of them will already box for a club. They'll be affiliated with an amateur club. I want to work with them coaches and say, look, here's my number, and if you need help with, let me know, and vice versa. And I want the kids to come in, and I just want to technically improve them. I want to show them things, but pick out little faults, what they're doing wrong, and help them with some things, you know, work on their strengths as well, and just help them technically become better fighters. They're then going back home to the boxing clubs, and I'm sure the coaches will be happy with the improvements they're making. And they're not going to be coming there all burnt out. I'm not going to run them into the ground in the day, because I know they've got the clubs to go to in the night. They may have sparring coming in the night. The coach can send me a little text, say, look, we've got a big session tonight, whatever. I'll do a little bit more video analysis and stuff like that with them, and make sure they've had a good day, but still learned and still improved without burning themselves out.
You mentioned the video analysis there. That's something that underpins a lot of the Access stuff. Also underpins a lot of the shifts in boxing. You know, there's now greater resource, greater facility, greater tech, and the fighters themselves getting to go through that. That's part of a learning experience for them. It's part of an improvement for them. It's part of a feedback thing, and I think that we've, you know, I think that we felt spent too long educationally where the only feedback that a lot of children get is a grade, rather than the idea of day-to-day feedback they've got to learn from and improve from, and this is a really good opportunity.
100%, and I think, you know, speaking from experience as well as everyone else, everyone will probably agree with me, sometimes you get told something, you're doing wrong, look, you're doing this, and you'll go through the motions of whether it be throwing a punch, whether it be kicking a ball, whatever you're doing technically, you won't really know until you see it. And then when you see it, as I say, if someone's videos it and you watch it, and you see, say, for example, if you would, every time you throw your jab, you drop your right hand, you won't know you're doing it because you're just concentrating on throwing that jab. All of a sudden, we video it and show you it back, and you see it, and it makes you laugh. You think, wow, I didn't realise I was doing that. And it's a lot easier to learn from sometimes, and it's just a different eye, it's massive. So whether it be, as I say, kicking a ball, you might not realise what you're doing technically wrong. When the coach is telling you, might think, nah, no, I'm putting it in the top corner, it's all right. When you look at it technically and you see a video of it, you think, wow, didn't realise I was doing that. And it's so easy to learn from just another angle and seeing it, what other people are seeing.
Just going back to Stephen's previous point about the gyms as well, I think that's something we were really, you know, passionate about doing, is supporting the gyms in that way. If there's gyms that maybe haven't got certain resources or certain facilities or technology, you know, we want to bring that to that gym or allow the, you know, the boxers to experience it on the programme. So I think what Stephen's saying there about, you know, adding that kind of, just putting a little bit of icing on top maybe, but we know, and Stephen knows a lot more than me, that the coaching that goes on at the clubs in Merseyside across the board is exceptional anyway. We're not trying to change these boxers or make them something else. We're just trying to give them a little bit of something that maybe the coaches sometimes don't have time to do, or maybe they just need a bit of one-to-one support with that. And I think that's a really important point, yeah.
When we spoke in the week, Gary, one of the things we were talking about was the background. A lot of all the access facilities existing, so the communities that access are looking to get 16 to 18-year-olds from, and where the facilities are. There's right the way across the country, because the facilities are right the way across the country. It's not just in the Northwest or even in Liverpool. Yeah. Right the way across the country with access, there is a desire, isn't there, to keep children between the ages of 16 and 18 in education from certain deprived areas within the country. That's something that access, that's where these facilities are, that's where they're based, and that's the community you're looking to get to.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's huge colleges in every city where, you know, everyone knows where they are, and you know, people who've got the luxury can drive into there every day. We're trying to support more than anything else the young people in inner city areas who maybe all they can do every day and all they've got an ability to do is walk to that gym every day. If that's where they're comfortable being, you know, we want to provide that education in an environment where they're comfortable, where they feel supported, and where they feel like they can take that next step. And, you know, we really want to, you know, we're really passionate about that. So supporting, you know, again, children, young people in them inner city areas and giving them aspirations that they can go further than maybe just getting a job in a factory. No disrespect, because it's, you know, it's employment, but we want them to aspire and feel like they can achieve everything they want in life, and that's what our programs are about.
Your kid's doing something next week. Yeah. How's he looking? How's he feeling? How's it going with Liam?
Do you know what? Liam looks really well. He looks really good. I think this move up in weights suits him. And it's good that it's come as an opportunity for him. But he's looking really well in the gym. He's looking happy. And, you know, we always say a happy fighter's a dangerous fighter. And it's a fight what he's right up for. He doesn't like Eubank too much. So it's not too hard for him to get in there and want to go through the motions and get on with it.
You looking forward to it?
Yeah, I am. You know, I'm excited. As I say, being in watching Liam sparring, and I'm really happy where he's at. I think he's bubbling nicely now, and you know, he's ready to go next week.
Excellent stuff. Listen, all the Access stuff we've been doing, we're going to continue with it on the Anfield Wrap. Tell you the story of what it is Access are trying to do in a number of communities across the next few weeks and months. You'll be hearing more and more from different people who get to act as mentors, as coaches in amongst the Access programmes, on top of all the educational opportunities that they offer. If you are intrigued and want more information, you can go to accesssport.ac.uk/TAW, and there you'll be able to sign up, get more information for you or for anyone else that you know, any young people that you know, any relatives, feel free to speak to them and pass that along. It's accesssport.ac.uk. Thank you very much. /TAW. Good luck, get that bit right, otherwise we don't collect the numbers. Thank you very much indeed to Stephen and Gary for taking the time coming in on this Friday morning. Keep your eye out for Liam's fight a week on Saturday, a week tomorrow. Let's hope he gets on very, very well indeed.
And it's John Gibbons in the studio with Adam Rowe, who we've had on before for the first time together in the same space. So, Adam, thanks so much for coming in. Really appreciate it.
No, thanks for having us. It's an absolutely wonderful space. And, yeah, first time not on Zoom. There's not that, like, three-second delay you get with a Zoom meeting. It's impossible to do, especially when you're a comedian and you get invited onto anything. Obviously, yeah. This is a football podcast, but when you're introduced as a comic, there's still got to be an inch of comic timing with some of the things you say. And Zoom just made that pretty much impossible, which is why I didn't do many comedy shows on Zoom during the pandemic. Like, and I'm glad we can actually be sat in here now with a coffee. And
both with trousers on.
Yeah.
So there you are. We had a little chat before we waited for the studio. We worked out it's almost a year to the day since you were last on. And so yeah. We're here to talk about your new show, Imperious, which is out now on YouTube. I watched last night and was brilliant. But it'd be nice, first of all, to reflect on that year, because it's been fantastic for you, for the things you're involved with. And, you know, did you allow yourself a bit of reflection at the end of the year, everything you'd achieved?
I suppose I had my reflection a couple of weeks before the end of the year, because... obviously, I, as you know, and I'm sure there's a handful of listeners who might have seen some of the stuff we do. The podcast I do, which is comedy, is called Have a Word, and we did our biggest ever show. We did the M&S Bank Arena on the 9th of December. The days that immediately followed that felt like the end of the year to me.
Yeah.
Like, that was my Christmas this year, do you know what I mean? getting to play an arena with, like, a load of my mates and the co-host and the producers we work with, that felt like a big moment. But I suppose that's... When you've just asked me that question, that's the first time I've thought about what the last year's been like. I think the last time I came on was to talk about the tour I was about to do, which was the Imperious Tour. That started in February and ran through right to the end of June. And that's the show that's now available on YouTube. It's on the Have a Word YouTube channel as a stand-up special. But yeah, it's been quite a mad year. And there's just such a combination of the stuff I've done with my own stand-up, the stuff with Have a Word and culminating in the arena at the end of it, but also following Liverpool, like, and going to... I've been very lucky over the past few years as I've started to do all right with my career. I can afford to go to more games and take more time off.
Mm.
Like, I've always gone to match, but I've never managed to quite make it to more than as many away games as I have over the past few years.
Because you're probably working that night.
Yeah, and trying to, like, schedule... Like, it's quite easy to schedule, like, a gig when we're at home, because I can just leave from Liverpool. But, like, getting down to Brighton for an away game and then getting to Birmingham for a tour show that night has always just been difficult, especially when you first start and there's no freedom to pick and choose. It's just a promoter's like, I want you this date or you don't do the gig. So you've just got to do it. And I missed some games for a good few years there, like, while I was on my way up. But now I'm in a position where I can go to the promoters and be like, hey, Liverpool play Brighton this weekend, so I'm going to do Brighton then. Trying to book a comedy tour around it, yeah. I think the maddest night of the Imperious tour was the night before the Champions League final in Paris. I did the Philharmonic Hall in Liverpool. So it wasn't the one we filmed. Right. The one we filmed is from June, a month later. But the night before the final, I did the show at the Philharmonic Hall, went over the road to Frederick's and had 4 pints of Guinness, and then went straight to the airport and didn't go asleep at any point. So I did the biggest solo show I've ever done, ever. And then went straight to pub, straight to the airport, straight to fan park, and straight to game. And nice. God knows how I was still standing at the end of that day. Yeah.
Just sort of, you know, adrenaline. Just to reflect a little bit more on that arena show, because, I mean, fucking hell, the Guardian aren't going to talk about it. I had a really nice moment. I bumped into you the night after, and I was playing a gig myself, playing trumpet in the O2 Academy, and between sound check and the gig, there was a couple of hours in England. We're playing France, so I thought I'll nip out and watch the game somewhere. And this is me, like, telling over a elaborate story for why I was on my own and not a loser. So I just thought I would go to it. And I thought I'd go to Seniors Newgaff, I'll go to Danny Max and have a little look in there and go there and support that and watch the game. And yous were all in there en masse. Yeah. And you very kindly invited me to sit with you, which was nice because you were having, like, a moment together. But, you know, you said I'll pull up a chair and sort of watch it with us. And it was really nice because, like, I mean, yous were fucking hungover.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
But it was like, yous were all, like, I recognise it after you've done something boss together. You've got this, like, yeah, slightly hungover, but also this, like, proud beam about yous all that, like, you couldn't quite believe. Like,
I think that glow
off.
You could see, I think I hadn't long been sick when you arrived, to be honest. I think that's what it was.
To be fair, you were in the better condition than most. Maybe it was that sick.
Yeah, yeah. Do you know what had happened, right? So, straight after the arena show, obviously you're filled with pride and whatever, and we had an after party. So Luban, you know, in the Baltic area.
Yeah, Critch has been on, yeah, yeah.
So Dave very kindly shut his restaurant an hour earlier than he would have, kicked all of his customers out just before 11 and gave us the restaurant from 11 till like 3 in the morning. So we go there, and as I walked in, because we did that because we knew, like, nearly 10,000 of our fans were going to be out and about in the city centre. And as much as I wanted to go and party with them and see them, the people I really wanted to see were me dad,
yeah,
me missus, like all my friends from school who'd come. So we were like, let's have a little private party till the early hours and then we'll go into town until like 5 and we'll go to like Teddy's or something, which is exactly what we did. So we went there, and as I walked into Luban, like the bartender come over, because we'd done a little thing at Luban, so the bartender was sort of saying hello, and he went, do you want a drink? And I went, lad, I went, I'm telling you right now, for the next 2 hours, I'm going to be constantly just like moving around, talking to people I haven't seen for years. I went, can I be a bit of a diva? And he went, what? I went, I promise I'll give you an absolute bugger of a tip at the end of this shift. I went, could you make me a Woodford Reserved Old Fashioned? And every time you notice that it's nearly done, just do us another one and send them running out with it. And I promise I'll give you the tip of your lives. And he was like, absolutely not a problem. And literally every time I drank the last of me drink, like just come over, took it out,
so out of
me. Another.
Film,
it was, I felt like such a knob asking in the first place, but I was like, I'm not going to have time to go to the bar. Like, yeah, the amount of conversations I've got to have here. And he was so sound about it. And obviously I sorted them out at the end of it, but I was absolutely blitzed. Right,
yeah, Old Fashioned, like, it's a stern drink to be on all night.
It's just so I'd had like 4 or 5 beers like during the show, and I was just done with the lager, and they, yeah, don't sell Guinness in Luban, and I was like, I'm just gonna have to go on spirits, and that's my drink, and because it was the night, it was, I was like, I'm just gonna have me, yeah, the thing I like. But I was goosed. So apparently we leave the after party, went to Teddy's in town, and I'm stood at the bar just like talking to myself, and I'm really bad. All of my mates have, like, I've got a reputation for years for, I do not know when to leave it. Like, if someone will still serve me, yeah, I will stay out. I'll find. And if they tell me they're not serving me anymore, I'll go to another bar that I know is open later. I've been known to just disappear and just have my own night out. The night, not to get morbid, but the night of my mum's funeral, we had the wake in West Derby, and I disappeared from the pub. And my cousins and my little brother went straight to town and went to Pop World and checked there before they checked my bed, which is where I'd actually gone. I'd just gone home, and I got a phone call like an hour later. I'm asleep, and I was like, what's up? And they were like, where are you? I was like, I'm in bed. They were like, oh, we just thought you'd got a taxi to Pop World from West Derby. I lived in West Derby. They could have come and checked the house. They were like, he won't be there. He's gone.
That's the last place he'll be.
But after the arena, apparently I was just stood at the bar. My missus come over and was like, do you want anything? And I said, I want to go home. And just woke up the next day as hungover as I'd ever been. Went for breakfast with a load of the lads who'd been as part of the show. And then they'd already started again, so I started again. And then a few hours later, we seen you. Yeah. I was out till the very next morning when Paddy Pimbler fought. So I'd done the arena after party, woke up at lunchtime and went for brunch. And then just stayed out and on it until 6 o'clock in the morning. And I just remember, it was me and another comedian, we were the only two left, and we were just stood in a strip club because it was the only place that was showing the fight that would let us in.
Yeah.
And obviously the girls are coming over trying to earn their wages, going, do you want to dance and stuff? And we just had no interest. We were just like, we're just here for the fight. But I had to watch the fight through one eye. I had to close one of my eyes because I couldn't see if I had both my eyes open because it was so blurry. Yeah, quite the 48 hours.
But the parents, anyway, we hated to talk about that. And I watched it last night. It's brilliant. Well, I did get thinking because obviously, you know, you've had a really good year, really good sort of couple of years. But a lot of your comedy is quite personal. And yeah, I'm interested in the sorts of challenges around that, really, because you're not, you know, just speaking to, you know, a couple of hundred people in Hot House anymore or whatever it is. Yeah. You know, now it's sort of going out there. And, you know, is the challenges around that? Is the sort of conscience around that? You know, how do you sort of, you know, keep it kind of, because it's very relatable comedy and it's very, you know, well delivered and everything like that. But it's personal stories about your life. But the bigger you get, the more you must be sort of conscious of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of, I always look at stuff from like a mathematical point of view. So the bigger you get, the more people are going to like you, but also the more people are not going to like it. Because if you perform to 200 people and 20 of them hate you, you might not really notice that because 180 are laughing at you and it's great, yeah. And the 20 are just like, oh, they're not into it. If that's 10 million, then a million of them hate you.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And that's a lot louder. And you just have to, like, if it's relatable to 200 people, it'll be relatable to 10 million because it just scales. It just does. Yeah, you just got to be more willing to accept that people are going to love it. You're going to get more and more people who love and love and love it, and that snowballs. But the bigger you get, the more people are just going to not enjoy what you're doing as well. Especially the type of comedy I'm doing, I'm not trying necessarily to please everyone. A few years ago, I used to do the comedy I used to do when I first started stand up is not the type of stuff I do now. And I remember another comedian saying to me, would you pay to watch yourself? And I was like, no. And they were like, so what are you doing? Like, what are you doing then? You're just another comic added to the mountain of people who are already doing it. You should be doing the type of work that you would be proud to pay and go and see. And that's why I tried to sort of switch it up a bit and do slightly more challenging stuff and try and... I don't mind winding the audience up purposefully just so I can try and win them back.
Yeah.
But when you wind an audience up, you won't win them all back. If you're pushing the buttons of the people in the room just to watch them get uneasy, because if you put more tension into the room like that, then when you relieve it, the laugh's bigger.
Yeah.
But there's 10, 20% of them who are just now tense.
But you'll challenge them as well. You'll be like, why are you wound up about that?
Yeah,
why have you
reacted? Yeah, what's the matter with you? Yeah. And I think sometimes it can just help to just remind people where they are.
Yeah.
Just before Christmas last year, I did a show in Chester. So there's a tiny little, it's a music venue primarily, and it's a bar as well. It's called Alexander's. It's in Rufus Square in Chester. Yeah. Do you know what? Yeah. So they do comedy nights like once a week. And also I've done a few like work in progress shows there in the past couple of months. I love the room. It's great to do like a rough hour of stand-up in when you're getting ready for the tour. And it doesn't happen very often where people get upset at the show, but sometimes it does, do you know what I mean? And I said something, and a woman on the front row just went, I don't like that, no. And I won't give you the full context because it's taken me a while, but what she said was, you're basically just calling us all prostitutes, like every person in this room. I went, yeah, I am, yeah, but I don't mean it, do I? Because we're at a comedy. And this is how I said it. It was really patronising because she was drunk. I went, yeah, but I don't mean it, do I? Because I'm actually saying the opposite of what I think because it's funnier than what I do think. And if I was just up here saying what I think, it wouldn't be very entertaining. And she went, yeah, that's a good point, actually. She didn't argue with me. It was great. Like, sometimes you can get into that and, like, they'll start bickering back. And she went, and then she went, oh, yeah, actually, it doesn't matter. We are at a comedy show. And then she sat there and enjoyed the rest of the show. So sometimes you do just need to let people remember. This is a comedy club, by the way. And yeah. I'm not necessarily saying the things I believe to be true. I'm saying the funniest thing I can possibly say. And as you know, and as every person knows who's in a WhatsApp group, you don't necessarily say things you believe all the time. You're just trying to say the worst thing possible to make your mates laugh.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to make that translate to on stage, but that can get lost sometimes.
That said, next time you go to the doctors, you're a little bit worried about it.
So the routine you're mentioning is there's a routine about the GP's receptionist, which are quite universally hated, apparently, because that routine went well on every night of the tour. I put that clip on, like, all the social media. That was the lead clip for the special. On TikTok, the first comment is, I'm the receptionist at Hornsmith Medical Centre. And that's the real medical centre.
Yeah.
So I name it in this, because it's going on YouTube, it doesn't, like, have to comply with, like, broadcast laws and stuff, because it's just a YouTube channel. So I name Hornsmith Medical Centre. That routine, which is the very final routine in the show, I actually wrote that for Live at the Apollo. So when I did Live at the Apollo in 2021, I got booked for it in July and I was like, right, I'm going to just write a bit, spend the next 8 weeks nailing it, and then I don't have to use any of my old stuff on the thing. So I wrote that for the Apollo, but they didn't end up using it. They used the alternate bit. They used the other bit that I did. So I ended up just keeping that back and using it in the tour. But when I did it for that, I come off stage doing the biggest gig of my life. You know what I mean? Like, every comedian dreams of doing the Apollo at some point.
Yeah.
I come off and the producer's there, he's waiting in the wings. And I thought, because I'd had a really good gig, I thought he was there waiting to give me an high five saying well done. He was like, you need to get back out there now. And I was like, why? He went, you can't name the medical centre or the receptionist. He went, so go and change your name and change the name of the of the medical centre now. He's like, you need to just say the medical centre and pick a new name. Just go. And so I had to go back on stage at Live at the Apollo in front of 3,500 people and go, can you all just not leave yet? Can you sit down? Because I need to do another take of what I've just said for the edit because I can't name the medical centre. And the audience was so sad about it. They all stayed. They all let me do like essentially like an in-post edit of the routine.
Amazing.
Yeah.
And then they didn't even fucking use it.
And then they didn't even use it. They used me Victoria's Secret routine.
That was good as well.
But I was quite happy they didn't use it because it meant I already had 20 minutes of my next tour without having to do any work.
Just before we go then, next year, have you got much planned yet in terms of what you want to do? Obviously, you know, you continue on with the pod all the time. It's doing really well. But I'm sure in terms of your own stand-up, you've got plans for 2023.
Yeah, so... this weekend, actually, I'm going to Scotland and I'm recording my next special, which is called Juicy. That's going to come out sort of end of Feb, early March. From sort of the end of January onwards, once Juicy is filmed, I'll just start writing new material. And I think around March time, I'm going to announce my new tour, which will start in October. And that'll run right through till March 24. And also in the meantime, we're going to be doing our first sort of mini tour of Have a Word. So we've done a couple of outside of Liverpool shows so far, but we are looking at doing Glasgow, Newcastle, Dublin, maybe Belfast and Birmingham. And there's already a London show on sale. So we are taking Have a Word round because we've sort of for the first few years of Have a Word, we've been asking our fans to come to Liverpool and watch us.
Yeah.
But now we need to take the show to them and actually do a bit of legwork ourselves. So yeah, first half of the year is writing the next show and the Have a Word tour. Second half of the year will be my solo tour getting announced, and it'll start around October, I think, run through to December, have a little Christmas break, and then start again in 2024. And it seems quite terrifying to be thinking of 2024 already.
It's very the future. But there you are. Thanks for coming in. I would encourage everyone to get on Have a Weird Pod, YouTube channel, watch Imperius, have a good laugh, because, you know, it's later than you think and all that. But I made up with how well you've done, top man. I mean, I support anyone in this city, and I think everyone knows that. But, like, you're a good fella, so I'm really pleased.
Thank you very much, John. I appreciate it, love. Ta-da.
It is Tour Live. It is part two of Tour Live. For this bit, part four, if you're listening through other means, and we'll talk about directly that Brighton game, Adam. I mean, the obvious thing to say, first and foremost, is pick me a team. That's that's what I want to see what the manager's going to do. We're doing this before the press conference. There's rumours that Darwin may not be available, which somewhat scuppers my plans of play him off the left and see if you can really hurt them that way and get through the middle. What do you think the manager should be looking to do?
Yeah, it's a bit difficult before the press conference because is it confirmed that Firmino won't make it? It seemed like it was...
He's not the training photos again, so you're just sort of left feeling as though it's unlikely to be Firmino.
Somebody said, I think James Pearce might have said, that he didn't look like he'd made it, which is so frustrating, isn't it? Because it was, what was it, the 28th or something of December where he'd had a knock and he was just missing, you know, late fitness test. And
yeah, he doesn't play at Villa. And that's,
doesn't play at Villa and at Boxing Day. And so we're 2 weeks later and it's still, I don't know, it just seems to, I don't know whether that happens to other teams, but it's the most frustrating thing about following us, I think. It makes the front three a bit difficult, but if you assume they're both missing, then I guess it's got to be Gakpo, Salah, Ox. You'd pretty much, I think, you know, and midfield wise, I mean, it's that the big thing, isn't it? I'd have definitely started Keita the other day. Everybody probably would, I guess. That was say the other day. It was nearly a week ago, wasn't it?
I think it's mad he's not started either of the last two. Genuinely think it's mad.
It's not just based
off the results.
And is it as mad that he wouldn't have started this one? I'd have probably started that midfield that started the other day and this one and not Naby, but I don't know. I think, you know, it's probably not one player's fault, and I think somebody said it's almost like the ones that are playing that get it. Whoever's played gets it in the neck, and the one who hasn't, the one who misses out, is suddenly the saviour, whoever that is. So it's a tricky one, really. And so I think I wouldn't be surprised if he went the same again. To be honest, and I think I probably would have if I knew who was playing in general at the moment, and I didn't know who'd played last time and what the result was, I'd have picked that midfield. So probably go with that.
We know that they'll play under De Zerbi, Dan. They've gone to a really quite consistent back four. Now, who plays right back, I think, is a bit of a tell between Lamptey, Gross, and Veltman. If it's Veltman, it suggests that they're planning for the fact that they're in for a bit of a tough one. It shows a certain mindset. If it's Lamptey, I think it suggests they want to get at us. If it's Gross, it maybe just suggests that the other two are injured, to be quite honest with you. But he's done all right when he's played there, Gross, this season. He's a good footballer. In midfield, I think we can expect to see that they will have some combination of Caicedo, McAllister, Lallana maybe in there. They've got another couple of midfielders they do sort of dip in and out, and Gross is obviously available for selection there as well. They've got this new lad, Evan Ferguson, up front. They've been playing March off the right, and they've got Matoma off the left. That's what we can expect from them, because that's what they've been going with pretty consistently. Now, they did get beat 4-2 by Arsenal at home, and that game did get away from them a little bit. And again, because at the minute the way we are, we sort of, I think, presume anyone who's sort of around us is some sort of super team. You know, for me, this is a team that can be got at and has been got at in some unlikely areas over the course of this campaign. The flip side is they have scored 9 goals in the last 2. So how would you look to sort of set up against them?
I think the area in which you can get joy is down the flanks. So I think that Estupiñán, for example, is a really good player. At left back, they obviously sold Cucurella for an awful lot of money, but I think they've probably actually ended up with a better player, or certainly a player that is maybe a bit more useful for the way in which they now want to play under this manager anyway. But he's really, really attacking. He's great going forwards, and he can defend reasonably well, but it's not his strong suit. So if we're able to have Salah maybe start deep and be able to run at him or run at him off the ball, yeah, and someone's got it in midfield and look to play him in either through or over the top, then that would be really useful. Same on the other side, whoever plays really, because whether if it's Gross or Veltman, they're slow.
Yeah.
Or they're going to be slower than whoever's playing there.
The weird thing is Veltman's not good in the air either, but he's a good defender. he's not quick and he's not great in the air, but he is a really good defender.
If it's Lamptey's fast, but again, he'll be going significantly frequently more forward than the other two. So I think that's those are the most important positions on the pitch from a Liverpool within the game point of view, if that makes sense. Because we could have a midfielder that plays really well for once. But if good things aren't going on in those wide areas, then Liverpool are going to find it hard to score goals, I think. They defend pretty well in and around the box, unless Lewis Dunk throws a mad one in, which he is eminently capable of, but you can't plan for it. Can't be, or the way we're going to score a goal is just hope that Lewis Dunk kicks it in his own net or pulls someone over or something in the box.
And he's actually getting better as a player, I think, Dunk, as he grows older.
Yeah, he just has ropey ones. He's a defender in the ilk of like Lovren or Otamendi or something. Can have 6 absolutely great weeks and then just tug someone back, gives a penalty away, and you've lost.
I prefer us going there than having a man field, by the way. I don't know why that is, but I prefer. I think if you do get on top of them, not as a team. I think that the ground maybe does sort of packs in fairly early and was like, all right, well, we haven't won this one.
I think for me, there's a thing you said about a month or so ago, which is Neil, which is true. Sorry, you're definitely Neil. Which is the more they have to think about it, the better they are. And I think there's something about Brighton away where I agree with you, Adam, is that I think the reason I agree with you and a bit more confidence about it is I think going there, they'll have to think about it. Like, it's telling that after the game against Wolves, apparently the manager says, like, if you play like that against Brighton, you'll get swatted. Like, he's already thinking about it. And so I think they'll be going into this being really conscious of how they can hurt us much more. And it's able to get through to the players in a way that everything doesn't, if you're like,
I'd like to hear the manager say the word swatted, John.
I think there's also, but I don't think on that. I think this game is a lot to me, Dan. It's like Spurs away, where you know it's going to be unpleasant. You know you're going to a difficult place. You know you're coming up against a good side. I think they do the same thing against Villa on Boxing Day, to be honest with you. But there are good sides that are going to have to try and make some of the running. Like, I think one of the reasons why we do well against Spurs is that Spurs in their own ground feel as though they've got to make some of the running against us early.
Yeah,
and they're not that used to it. And I think that can play into our favour here. And what you're talking about in terms of finding space in behind, I think is a massive part of that.
Yeah, you then hope that they leave those spaces that you're subsequently set up to exploit. You know, Liverpool have done better in quite a few games this season where they've had less of the ball. I think what John's saying kind of fits into that as well, in that I think sometimes Liverpool, when they've had less time to think, have done better in kind of like 10-minute tranches of games and stuff. Like when they were when they came back out to Brentford and they did quite well for 10 or 15 minutes, it was just, well, we're going to have to fucking score, so we'll just play well. Like they did, there wasn't really like an overriding, oh, we're going to change like this and that, I'm going to play totally different. I know the players came on and stuff, but it was essentially the same shape. There was just, they were just forced into not really thinking and just doing the thing that made sense.
There was the thing that worries me, I guess, is that when it, you know, as John's just said, that the manager said something along the lines of, if we play like we did tonight against Brighton, we'll get twatted. And that is what, to me, it felt like everybody was saying at Anfield when we played Leicester, if we play like this against Brentford, we'll get swatted. And lo and behold, we did. We got swatted. So that we need. I think I can see some more green shoots in a sense against Wolves than I could against Leicester. Leicester was appalling. I couldn't believe, and it's shockingly bad. I couldn't believe, because I couldn't believe how bad we were, really. And I think Wolves...
Leicester wrecked my head so much. The first 30 minutes of Leicester was mind-boggling.
I still can't get my head around it, to be honest. I would like an explanation.
Like people to come in and just explain what it was that they were up to. Leicester was just unreal. To be in the ground... I'll remember being in the ground for Leicester the whole of my life.
Yeah. So, I mean, so Wolves, we at least scored two good goals. And... that's it. Basically, I was trying to think of all the positives, but I mean, we completely dissolved. So I don't know. And that needs to be addressed. Our mentality across 10-minute sections of games is just absent. As far as I can tell, there isn't a mentality. So that needs to be addressed. And I think, as you say, something like a Brighton is there's an element of it which is not like Brentford, which we knew would be really hostile, like going to Napoli almost, isn't it? You know, there's no time to think. The crowd's on top of you. They're probably going to score, and then you can't get your breath, and they've scored again. And I don't see that really from Brighton. But there's different things to cope with, despite them being a better team than Brentford. It's sort of a fixture I'd slightly rather be playing. Yeah. You know, it's along the lines of you could say Fulham as well. They're near each other in the table. It's probably them two doing well that's made it seem like the sort of season when anybody can beat anybody. But it's that kind of thing that we need to start turning round, because as we play our fixtures, we are always on paper the better team, and we always have things happening in a game which means that we should win. We've had zero luck. I think we need the first thing to happen tomorrow to be in our favour. The first main thing that happens being in our favour would help.
It would indeed. Dan, would you take 0-0 on 60? I'm not going to ask you for a prediction. Would you take 0-0 on 60?
Yeah.
Adam, would you take 0-0 on 60?
Absolutely, yeah.
John, would you take 0-0 on 60? Big thumbs up from John Gibbons there, taking 0-0 on 60. That's sort of where we are. 0-0 on 60 is absolutely fine in football matches, especially away games against top half teams. We've sort of forgotten that bit of football, I think, somewhere at Liverpool. And not in a sort of this is what it's like to come for the top four way. The year we won the league, there was a lot of games where Liverpool were tied 0-0 or 1-1 at the hour mark. It is away from home. It is absolutely fine for that to be the case in games of football that you play. And then you find your way through, and it creates doubt in opponents. So far this season, Liverpool have given opponents certainty, they've given them something to believe in, they've given them so much encouragement. Next four games, Reds, it starts tomorrow at the Amex. No encouragement whatsoever. Thanks to everyone who's been on the show. It's been Tour Live. See you later.
Sports Social Podcast Network.